There had been sewer folk before the Great Stink, of course, living in the Elizabethan sewers, or the Restoration sewers, or the Regency sewers, as more and more of London's waterways were forced into pipes and covered passages, as the expanding population produced more filth, more rubbish, more effluent. After the great programme of Victorian sewer building, that was when they came into their own. They could be found anywhere in the length and breadth of the sewers, but they made their permanent homes in some of the church-like red brick vaults towards the east, at the confluence of many of the churning, foamy waters. There they would sit, rods and nets and improvised hooks beside them, and watch the surface of the brown water. They wore clothes, brown and green clothes, covered in a thick layer of something that might have been mould, and might have been a petrochemical ooze, and might, conceivably, have been something much worse. They wore their hair long and matted. They smelled more or less as one would imagine. Old storm lanterns were hung about the tunnel. Nobody knew what the sewer folk used for fuel, but their lanterns burned with a rather noxious blue and green flame. It was not known how the sewer folk communicated amongst themselves. In their few dealings with the outside world, they used a kind of dumb show. They lived in a world of gurgles and drips, the men, the women, and the silent little sewer children. Dunnikin spotted something in the water. He was the chief of the sewer folk, the wisest and the oldest. He knew the sewers better than their original builders. Dunnikin reached for a long shrimping net. One practiced hand movement and he was fishing out a rather bedraggled mobile telephone from the water. He walked over to a small heap of rubbish in the corner and put the telephone down with the rest of their haul. The day's catch so far consisted of 2 odd gloves, a shoe, a cat skull, a copy of Fiesta, a sodden packet of cigarettes, an artificial leg, a dead cocker spaniel, a pair of antlers, mounted, and the bottom half of a perambulator. It had not been a good day. And tonight was a market night in the open air. So Dunnikin kept his eyes on the water. You never knew what would turn up. Old Bailey was hanging his washing out to dry. Blankets and sheets fluttered and blew in the wind on the top of Centre Point, the ugly and distinctive 60s skyscraper that marks the eastern end of Oxford Street, far above Tottenham Court Road station. Old Bailey did not care very much for Centre Point itself, but, as he'd often tell the birds, the view from the top was without compare. And, furthermore, the top of Centre Point was one of the few places in the West End of London where you did not have to look at Centre Point itself. The wind ripped feathers from Old Bailey's coat and blew them away, off over London. He did not mind. As he often told his birds, there were more where those came from. A large black rat crawled out through a ripped air vent cover, looked around, then came over to Old Bailey's bird-spattered tent. It ran up the side of the tent, then along the top of Old Bailey's washing line. It squealed at him, urgently.
"Slower, slower," said Old Bailey.
The rat repeated itself, at a lower pitch, but just as urgently.
"Bless me," said Old Bailey.
He ran into his tent and returned with weapons, his toasting fork and a coal shovel. Then he hurried back into the tent again, and came out with some bargaining tools. And then he walked back into the tent for the last time and opened his wooden chest and pocketed the silver box.
"I really don't have time for this tomfoolery," he told the rat on his final exit from the tent. "I'm a very busy man. Birds don't catch themselves, you know."
The rat squeaked at him. Old Bailey was unfastening the coil of rope around his middle.
"Well," he told the rat, "there's others could get the body. I'm not as young as I was. I don't like the underplaces. I'm a roof man, I am, born and bred."
The rat made a rude noise.
"More haste, less speed," replied Old Bailey. "I'm going, young whippersnapper. I knew your great-great-grandfather, young fellow me rat, so don't you try putting on airs. Now, where's the market going to be?
The rat told him. Then Old Bailey put the rat in his pocket and climbed over the side of the building. Sitting on the ledge beside the sewer, in his plastic lawn chair, Dunnikin was overcome by a presentiment of wealth and prosperity. He could feel it drifting from west to east towards them. He clapped his hands loudly. Other men ran to him, and the women and the children, seizing hooks and nets and lines as they did so. They assembled along the slippery sewer ledge in the sputtering green light of their lanterns. Dunnikin pointed, and they waited in silence, which is how the sewer folk wait. The body of the Marquis de Carabas came floating face down along the sewer, the current carrying him slow and stately as a funeral barge. They pulled it in with their hooks and their nets in silence and soon had it up on the ledge. They removed the coat, the boots, the gold pocket watch, and the contents of the coat pockets, although they left the rest of the clothes on the corpse. Dunnikin beamed at the loot. He clapped again, and the sewer folk began to ready themselves for the market. Now they truly had something of value to sell.
"Are you sure the Marquis will be at the market?" Richard asked Dor, as the path began slowly to climb.
"He won't let us down," she said, as confidently as she could. "I'm sure he'll be there."